Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Friday, October 23rd, 2015. It's the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week. Every week, two experts in the world of the federal government choose the three stories they think are most important to people who work in the federal government. They rank them in order from number three to number one, and we count them down on the Federal News Countdown. This week is John Salamone of FMP Consulting. It's great to see you, my friend. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Francis.
And Karen Evans, it is great to see you. Thank you for being here, head of the U.S. Cyber Challenge.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to do it. And you've each chosen three great stories, so we'll start where we always do with...
Number three!
Karen, your choice is the third most important federal news story of the week from FCW. The headline is DHS CISO eyes shift from perimeter defense to data protection. And to be fair, Jeff Eisensmith is not the only one who's doing this in government, right?
That's right. And I was happy to see that this is the headline. As you know, I always try to pick a theme as I go through with my stories. And data, it's all about the data. And I've been saying that for years, that it's all about the data. So this was a very encouraging headline for me, that it seems like the trend is finally picking up, that people are really looking at what are my information holds, what are the most important things that I have. This has always been what CIOs are supposed to look at, and they should be protecting what are the most important data stores and how do we protect those. The other part of this, which still makes me a little sad, is the idea of the perimeter defense and the whole idea of spending money on perimeter defense, when in fact you should actually have your security program set up with the fact that they're already in. So how do we protect things based on the assumption that they're already in our networks?
John, you were nodding your head in agreement when she said she was sad about the perimeter defense element.
I'm not an IT expert. When I read that article, though, last night, that was the first thing that I picked up on, is that they're already in. So are we giving up on the perimeter, and should we really be securing the data within the network? And again, once the bad actors get in, how hard is it to find them, because they can embed so deep into the data?
Right. And so the idea is you should operate from the assumption they're already in. We have evidence of that. You can see that. So to me, if the government and any industry, any company, if they are still operating from, I can build a perimeter, I can build a moat, that is an outdated philosophy as far as I'm concerned when you're dealing with cybersecurity and trying to protect your data.
What do you think it'll take to change that culture, that concept?
Well, one would think it would have changed with the OPM breach.
You would think, and the quote that I underlined at the bottom of the article was, I think from Secretary Johnson, saying the only caveat would be if a new threat pops up tomorrow that changes the maturity level. So I wrote a note down to myself. It's almost like a whack-a-mole approach. I mean, are we being as proactive as we possibly can with our policies and with our IT systems to actually stay ahead of the bad actors?
I mean, we can pretty much guarantee a new threat's going to pop
Absolutely.
Up at some point
yeah.
in the future.
Absolutely.
Something we don't know anything about today.
And then the other part of this article, which I thought was kind of interesting, is the idea of the continuing diagnostics and mitigation versus Einstein. It's not a versus. It's you need both of those together in combination in order to really secure what your data assets are. So I'm a little concerned that it's kind of this versus approach, or one is better than the other. Both of them are complementary, and you need both of those going forward.
Okay, as former essentially federal CIO, is that an education process on the part of each of the CIOs, or is that somebody like Tony Scott saying, no, start thinking about it differently today, and then trying to drive that behavior through budget incentives or other kinds of incentives?
It's the latter, where Tony Scott, I think, has already started down that path with several initiatives, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more. But he has several initiatives underway which will drive that culture change, so that secretaries and deputy secretaries are looking at what are the most important assets that we own. The government manages data. That's the number one thing that they have. It's all about the data and what they have, and from intelligence to personnel data, whatever. It's all about data. So you have to really look at what do I own and how do I secure that based on the risk that's associated with it.
Karen Evans's choice is the third most important federal news story of the week is from FCW. The headline is DHS CISO eyes shift from perimeter defense to data protection. John Salamone, your choice at number three is from the Washington Post. The biggest government backlog's getting worse, Watchdog says, but Social Security has a plan. The disability benefits backlog for a long time was attributed just to a judge's problem. There weren't enough eyeballs on all of these cases. What's your takeaway from what we're learning from the Post article?
Well, it's so interesting because the reason I chose this is that it's almost like Back to the Future. I worked on this issue when I was on Senator Voinovich's staff. We actually had a hearing in Cleveland in March of 2004 on this issue. And from my standpoint, it's much more complicated than just the backlog of cases on the back end of the process. There are so many unique challenges, I think, that can be identified. First and foremost, it's the way that individuals apply for disability goes into the Social Security, and then Social Security sends the disability claims to the states to determine whether individuals are eligible or not. And when you have 50 states looking at issues, there are wide variations in terms of adjudication, which raises questions on whether people are being looked at fairly or consistently across the board. So I think we really have to understand the data in terms of, you know, the denial rates, the accuracy rates across the nation. So it's not just the back end. There are a lot of other factors that play into this as well.
Mm-hmm. What do you see when you look at this, Karen? It's not an easy solution, but it's also an issue that appears to be getting worse. Someone to hear whether their appeal would be approved or denied was 435 days on average. As of March, the average wait jumped by 15 days, according to the IG's work here.
Well, when I look at this, of course, I always look at things through how can we improve the business process through information technology, right? And so it talks about newly electronic generated data, the interaction between what John was talking about between the feds and the state. A lot of this is going to have to do with how do we optimize the data transfers and how do we make this work so that they're actually operating from a comprehensive set of data in order to streamline it, right? So that they can make consistent decisions. Again, I'm back to data. I was actually pretty excited when I saw that John had picked this article because I said, oh, it's right in line with the whole idea of, you know, the government managing data. How do you manage data to improve business processes and improve it for the citizens? And that's exactly what this is. That's what eGov is all about. That's what the interaction between the feds and the state partners are about, is how do you streamline that data so that you can make consistent decisions and then get them done faster? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
New electronically generated data has helped the agency determine which appeals could be screened by attorneys and federal claims examiners who can make decisions themselves faster than judges. The number of attorneys being increased, enhancing the quality of video hearings in remote locations where there are no judges. There's a lot of opportunity here, it sounds like, for information technology to improve this process.
Yeah, and none of that is new. Those are things that Social Security disability process was going through, and Commissioner Barnhart was... She came to Cleveland, testified, and they were doing the same exact things. I think part of the problem is, and I'm not going to get into a debate about the definition of disability, but the definition that they use to determine disability doesn't match with the Americans with Disabilities Act. It is much more rooted in 1950s theory of disability, and it doesn't keep pace with medical advancements or rehabilitation advancements. You know, you also have to look at the fact that in 2009, I looked at the data this morning before I came here, we had a spike in disability claims from 2009 to 2011, and that is expected when there's high unemployment. When there's high unemployment, disability is going to spike, the claims are going to spike, and that's going to create more of a backlog, which is why I think we have to have better consistency on the front end. And the attorneys, they're getting dinged for not being consistent or actually offering good decisions. The judges are only processing two claims a day. You know, we need to get more judges, or actually ramp up the judges in terms of holding them accountable for hearing the cases.
They want to bring the total judge cohort up to between 18 and 1900 by fiscal 2018. That's an increase, according to this piece in the Washington Post, of about 400. John Salamone's choice is the third most important federal news story of the week. The biggest government backlog is getting worse, Watchdog says, but Social Security has a plan, and you can read that story and all of the stories on this week's countdown linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week is selected by John Salamone and Karen Evans on the Federal News Countdown. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by John Salamone and Karen Evans. And we're up to
number two.
Karen, your choice says the second most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. The headline is Microsoft's plan to avoid a return to the digital dark ages in the wake of the safe harbor decision. What's the safe harbor decision, and why is it important to people who do information technology for the government?
So the safe harbor decision is the agreement that was between the EU and the United States about exchanging data back and forth. So a lot of the technology companies like Facebook, Google, all of those guys, they have data stores all over the place. And what the EU said was, okay, the agreement, the safe harbor agreement between us and the EU, we've invalidated that. So the way that they were ensuring privacy for European citizens and European data was they were self-certifying that they had privacy practices in place. And the EU said, we don't believe you anymore. So we're not going along with the safe harbor agreement. So now technology companies, which most of them, right, the big ones are here in the United States, they have major issues in dealing with consumer data going over to European Union countries. But it's also a big problem here because to John's point about disability and the old laws with disability, it's the same thing as it relates to computers and how everything has worked. So you're seeing this now with the information sharing bill up on the Hill. You're seeing it with a bunch of different legislation. Our laws are antiquated, which our policies are built on. And so if you want to take advantage of cloud technology, well, those servers are all over the place. The data is all over the place. So if these treaties and these agreements are null and void, how do you build technical solutions and take advantage of that innovation if you don't have an underlying pinning legal system supporting it?
The Microsoft plan, the story says, John, is perhaps the most detailed roadmap released by a company in the wake of the safe harbor decision and would require significant changes to law. That seems to be the most difficult thing for us to consider in Washington is when technology governance requires legislation, Congress does not always move as quickly as it could. And there are a lot of people who believe that Congress doesn't always understand the issues to the level that it should.
Right, most definitely. And I think the one thing that you have to look at, too, is when you start to open up the books on privacy concerns, then we're looking at surveillance techniques. And when we reopen, the intelligence factors that play into this. I found it interesting that the Microsoft CEO was the one blogging about this. And the thing that kind of came to my mind is, you know, are these companies concerned, are U.S. companies concerned that we're now no longer in compliance with the agreement? There's data's got to be going back and forth still, I would imagine, right now. I mean, most definitely. And are there fees going to be associated? Are they, like, is the European Union going to impose fees on U.S. companies because we're no longer compliant? Or
well, and that really is the basis of a lot of this. And if you look through the blog post of what he has a very sound legal framework for people to consider. So it's to your point, Francis, about educating Congress so that Congress knows what the issues are. But there are legal things, and this, I believe, all stems out in the bottom part of this article talks about Edward Snowden and the surveillance issues. And so we still have these issues dealing with surveillance and how that was brought about. But you really do, if you sit there and you think about it, how do you really want the data to go back and forth? When you go and travel, like the example the Post article gives is when you go and travel, you know, you want to be able to go abroad. This has bigger ramifications because I want to go over and go to London, for example. Well, my data's got to go with me, mm-hmm. and it has to be able to be exchanged back and forth because I'm not on the no-fly list and things like that, right? Well, so this has huge ramifications going back and forth. And so I think, John, to your point, some of those questions need to be answered, like how is that going to work? And then if we do have law enforcement issues, how is that going to work? Because if we want to open up our borders and have global companies come to the United States as well, right? So China has companies here in the United States. Do you want China's laws to now prevail on the United States citizens because it's a China company? And, you know, I mean, how is that going to work? And we've been raising the issues. The tech industry has been raising issues for years about how do you really want to handle this? And I think it's at the point now where we really need to answer those questions.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Karen Evans. It's from The Washington Post. The headline is Microsoft's plan to avoid a return to the digital dark ages in wake of safe harbor decision. John Salamone, your choice at number two on the Federal News Countdown this week in 2015 could have been probably a choice from this week in 2005 and in 1995, and we can just keep going back and back and back. It's a GovExec story with the headline, Federal Managers Increasingly Unhappy with the Hiring Process. The story included here is from GovExec. The story included here in the GovExec story is news, but the concept certainly isn't news, John.
No, it's definitely not. And it's so funny, as you were setting up the intro, the first words that came to my mind as I was glancing at the story again is Back to the Future.
Uh-huh.
And most definitely, these issues are not going away. They have to go away. I mean, I think there are some, if I'm going to look at the data, there are some positive aspects to having hiring managers involved with workforce planning. But the fact that we only have 43% of hiring managers personally participating in recruitment and outreach efforts for their vacancies, I think is abysmal and something that we have to work on. I think we have got to continue to promote the human capital as a shared responsibility between the hiring managers and HR. And as a matter of fact, I think the hiring managers have to own a lot of the process. And some of this is not just, it's not very glamorous to talk about, but quite honestly, you know, OPM's talked a lot about the timeliness of hires, and we're starting to talk a little bit about the quality of hires, but how do you get quality applicants in? You have to have good processes on the front end, to Karen's point about looking at the end-to-end process. Do we have a good assessment process? Are we really talking and working with the subject matter experts to understand what the competencies are of the jobs that we're recruiting for so we can get good assessment techniques and get the right talent in the door?
Karen, here's where the siren went off for me. OPM and the White House reported the lowest levels of satisfaction with the pool of candidates looking to join the top ranks of civil service. It's worse for the hiring managers who want to bring people into the senior executive service than it is for the managers who are bringing people into the government for the first time. Less than half of hiring managers, this piece says, were satisfied with the quality of senior executive service managers, down 13 percentage points in the most recent quarter from the 60% baseline. Across government, just about half of employees said the skill levels of their coworkers has improved, according to the most recent Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey. That means people are looking around at their peers and going, they don't know how to do their jobs very well.
Well, and I have the opportunity to train potential leaders through the Office of Personnel Management, and you do see that. Like, I go over this data all the time, and I think, to John's point, this is the tail end of some of the issues that when you started out this article about, you know, what's happened in 1995 and those types of things of the way that people were promoted in the past, which was, you know, in order to keep good technical people, we're going to put them in a management track because we haven't really thought about they should be in a technical track versus a management track. And so I think you're at the tail end of that, because I know this administration has really worked at looking at SES, just as the Bush administration was toward the end. This administration has picked it up just for that issue that you're talking about, because managers have to be able, SES have to be able to manage a multitude of people. The technical expertise is down the next level. And so they have to be able to lead and manage. They have to be able to inspire and manage to outcomes. And that's a different set of skills to John's point about, you have to be very clear about what you're looking for, and the hiring personnel people can help you find the right people. But if you're not clear about what you want that person to do in the job, that's why you're dissatisfied. So if you don't own the process jointly with the personnel department, you're not going to be happy with the quality of applicants that you get.
John Salamone's choice is the second most important Federal News story of the week from GovExec, Federal Managers Increasingly Unhappy with the Hiring Process. And that story is at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, a link there, as well as links to all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown. When we come back, the most important Federal News stories of the week as selected by John Salamone and Karen Evans on the Federal News Countdown. You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, the three most important federal news stories of the week on the Federal News Countdown every Friday. And this week it's Karen Evans and John Salamone choosing the stories, and we're up to
number one.
John, your choice at number one is from GovExec. The headline is House Passes Measure to Streamline DHS Offices and Boost Employee Morale, and that's the solution. We needed to pass a law to tell people at the Department of Homeland Security that they should like their jobs better. Am I too cynical?
Francis, you stole my punchline.
Oh,
I mean, honest to God, can we just
I'm
go
so
to Karen,
sorry.
Please, now? My story is over.
I ruined it. Dang it.
So here's,
great minds think alike.
Absolutely. Okay, well, then I'm built back up. Thank you. I appreciate it. So from my standpoint, I looked through the legislation yesterday. I didn't read. It's probably 70 pages. But there are a couple pages in there that outline new responsibilities for the chief human capital officer. Things like strategic workforce planning, developing strategies to recruit, hire, train the department's employees, developing career pathing for leaders. And then the legislation also outlines some component strategies that the CHECO must oversee in terms of building a five-year workforce plan. I mean, I think your point is well taken. I recognize that DHS has some ongoing challenges, but I don't see anything in this legislation, at least from a human capital standpoint, that isn't already covered by the CHECO Act and by GIPRA modernization. So we don't need another law passed to basically put new requirements on a DHS CHECO that aren't on the same, that don't cut across to other chief human capital officers. So I think great oversight of the department. We need it. We need to focus on engagement. We need to get to the points of why their leadership scores are so low compared to the rest of the federal government. And there are a lot of legacy issues. There are a lot of complicating factors with DHS. But passing a law is not going to solve the problem.
There's an underlying message here, Karen, that maybe Congress didn't even intend, but that I'm going to derive from the way this legislation's been written. Catherine Emerson, the chief human capital officer at DHS, has taken a fair amount of flack from some of these same people that are pushing this bill about the state of morale at Homeland Security. It strikes me that this is a tremendous endorsement for her and her office to say, we want to give you and your office a lot more autonomy than you've had before, and we want to give you oversight and responsibility for working with the components, and we want to, it sounds like she's getting a lot more latitude than she's had before.
Well, and I think what's here and in this bill is kind of they're jump-starting what the CIOs used to sit there and argue about, right? And so you had Fitara that went through, but they're giving her that ability to be able to deal with the components. And so if you have a large department like Department of Homeland Security, or you could do VA or anybody else like that. This is them saying, okay, let's look, we really want the department to run as a department. So these oversight functions, these management functions, they need to have the authorities, or they need to be recognized. And a lot of times in the case, not to pick on DHS, but DHS's argument is, we don't have the authority in statute, so that we can't do the things that you want us to do because there's no authority in statute. So I know John is sitting here saying, well, we don't need another law, but I bet you on the back end of this, what she's saying is, I would love to address these things, but I need to hold up a piece of paper that says that I have the authority. I mean, if you look at the component organizations within DHS, they probably brought in the hardest components from every department and put them together. I mean, Secret Service didn't really listen to Maine Treasury, right? Coast Guard, you know, didn't listen to transportation. I mean, if you look at the components that are in there, the only way that that department could have been made any worse is if they brought the FBI over from Department of Justice and put them in there as well.
So I think part of the problem stems from 9/11 Commission recommendations. I worked on the Hill when Homeland Security was passed. Congress still hasn't reorganized itself to align with the department, and that is part of the problem. I think the components have a different authority. So Commerce goes in and asks Coast Guard, what are you, Commerce Committee's going and ask Coast Guard, what are you doing from Human Capital Strategy? They're not beholden to the Gov Affairs
That's
Committee.
Right.
And that causes a lot of tension as well. I think, you know, the component piece is critically important. You need a strong leader at the Chico level to galvanize the components, bring them together, set up an internal Chico council for the components to work together collaboratively. I'm sure they have it at DHS, but strengthening that, Congress bear some of this responsibility as well.
And it doesn't seem like it would take very long for Congress, if this works the way they want it to say, hey, this is working pretty well at DHS. And as you said, John, not every agency has this, but I would think it could spread fairly quickly.
Well, and you would want it to, right? Because who would not want their human capital be managed this way? Who would not want to have, you know, good leadership scores? And, you know, the mission at DHS really jazzes a lot of people. What happens is when they get in there, the organizational structure and the bureaucracy really disappoints a lot of them. And so that's why they don't feel that they can really move forward. And so the response is, let's do a reorganization, which I think is a typical government response. Let's do a reorganization. Let's pass a statute. Let's do this. But it's really going to come down to, and it's related to John's other article with the hiring process and the managers, you have to have good leadership in there. And if you have good leaders, then they'll be able to be able to move forward and move through the bureaucracy. So these two have to go hand in hand.
John Salamone's choice is the most important federal news story of the week. It's from GovExec. The headline, House passes measure to streamline DHS offices and boost employee morale. And I really am sorry I stole your joke. I really hate that. And so I apologize for that. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week is selected by Karen Evans, and I'll check with you during the commercial for what you want to say so I don't steal it from you.
Okay.
All
okay.
Right. The federal news countdown continues in a moment on In Depth with Frances Rose. Back on In Depth with Frances Rose, the Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by John Salamone and Karen Evans. And Karen, your choice at number one is my colleague Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com. The headline is OMB initiates cyber marathon with long-awaited policy update. And I have to confess, as soon as I saw this, thinking that you were going to be on the countdown this week, I couldn't imagine a menu of your choices that didn't include an update to Circular A-130. I just knew that you were going to have something on this.
Well, this is the most exciting thing that I think is happening in all of federal government is the update of A-130.
It is, John, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yes, it is. And it hasn't, the circular, this underlying circular hasn't been updated since 2000. And it is the foundational piece or circular that OMB has that deals with privacy and security and information systems and how you manage capital planning, how you do all this. So if you think about all the different pieces of legislation that has passed since 2000, it was critical that this underlying circular be updated. I mean, when you kind of, you look at, now only policy wonks would really get excited about this, right? The statute passes and then OMB either does a memo or a circular. And it goes down and circulars live forever. Okay, memos can be rescinded on, but a lot of, you know, a lot of us who wrote OMB policy memos, we still look at the website and say, oh, that policy memo is still in place. I'm still out there. But the circulars are ones that you really try to get the framework right, because in the amount of time that you go through to update it, the public comment, everything that needs to go in place for the circular.
John, with no disrespect intended to our IT friend, I wonder if you were as jazzed up as Karen was when you saw this.
I got jazzed up at the very end of the article when they started talking about human capital.
All right, fair enough.
So that A130 has new requirements for the CIOs to be actively involved in the recruitment process, right?
Right.
What we were just talking about. So those things absolutely should be happening. And I was very pleased to see, CIOs, the push for performance metrics in here as well. I'm curious. I mean, I think, you know, if it hasn't been updated since 2000, it's out for public comment for, I think, 30 days.
Right.
What's the process in terms of how long it's going to take to get it finalized and approved?
Well, this particular circular has really gone through a lot of informal within the government, going through the Chico Council, going through the privacy officers, going through the CIO Council. And Tony Scott's team really did do a lot of outreach into associations and different groups like ACT, IACT, those types of folks like that, to really get a lot of input before it went to the formal process. So really, I think what you're going to see within this 30 days is maybe the outliers, the people who may have not been inclusive in a lot of the associations, because they did go to a lot of the associations and said, here's what we're thinking about doing. The part that will be hard is if somebody really dug their heels in hard. Like, I'm a big person on the performance measures, so I'm glad that the metrics are in there. But I'm one who's going to go through and really look at the details of this as well and will offer comments. When they bring it back in, they're going to do a final comment resolution piece. And so it's going through the regular federal regulations process, right? So they're going to have to publish what they did with the resolution of the comments and why they did what they did. So it'll be very transparent at this point, which is wonderful.
The astute observation on your part, John, about the elements of this that pertain to human capital, and it fits with the discussion I had with a current chief information officer a couple of days ago, in which I pointed out that I think the most important part of FITARA is that it will transition the role of CIO sufficiently that the most important job, a part of that job title, will be the chief part and not necessarily the information part. It will turn those people a lot more into executives that are managing organizations than IT specialists necessarily. Is that a fair observation on my part, do you think?
Karen, go first. I actually do think that was the intended outcome of FITARA, was to really get them to be executives, and that CIO should be strategic. And if you look at the evolution of CIOs and where they came from, when Klinger Cohen passed, what really happened was they just took the IT operations guy, what we were called IRM at that point, the IRM division director, and made them into a chief information officer, which was an operations kind of guy, the IT operations guy. So this is really taking all of those different pieces and saying, okay, now we're going to take the circular and update it, because they really should be looking at human capital. They should be looking at long-term planning. They should be looking at data stores, privacy, all of those things, and looking at strategically how does an agency or a department move forward managing through technology. So you use technology as an enabler. People have always talked about that, but they have to be executives, and they have to be on a par with the chief financial officer, right? With the Chico, with the they have to be strategic advisors to the DepSec and the secretary about this is how you want to be able to move forward and do this. And this is the risk model that we have in place. And here are the data stores that we have. And then here are the workforce requirements that we need.
There's a school of thought that I'm starting to hear, especially in the vendor community, but also somewhat in the government community, John, is that may, in the next 3 to 5 years, precipitate a little bit of turnover in the ranks of the CIOs and CISOs and so on, as they see what's required, and they go, not really the kind of job or description that I signed up for.
Yeah, it was interesting to listen to Karen describe the process for creating the CIOs, because it's the exact same process and reasoning that we created the Chief Human Capital Officers. And I think we have to push all of the C-suite executives to be more strategic, to work more collaboratively across the enterprise, to integrate with the chief operating officer. I think the next administration coming in has a tremendous opportunity to really elevate the C-suite functions, to be much more strategic, to implement GIPRA modernization and all of these good government practices across all of the enterprise in a very coordinated fashion.
You're nodding your head in agreement with that, Karen?
Well, because it really does take all these different components to really make a good department so that it can affect good outcomes for the American people, right? So what this does is take away a lot of the arguments that CIOs have had for years, or that Chico's may have in partnering with CIOs, like you need to be involved in this process. So this circular really lays out roles and responsibilities of DHS, of OPM, of OMB. And the other part of it, which I think, like you see it kind of sprinkled through here, is that OMB is not alleviated of its oversight role. OMB still has to do what it was always intended to do, which is the management and oversight of the agencies to achieve the outcomes. And so I'm really excited about this. I know, you know, not necessarily anybody else's, but I'm pretty excited that we've gotten to this point that this is out for public comment, because it's going to remove a lot of barriers to success.
Karen Evans's most important federal news story of the week is OMB initiates cyber marathon with long-awaited policy update. It's my colleague Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com, and you can find it and all of our selections on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. A terrific Federal News Countdown. Thanks to you, John Salamone, for doing it. And thanks to you, Karen Evans, for being on today. I appreciate both of you coming in and joining me. The Federal News Countdown is on hiatus next week, as I am on vacation. And it returns 2 weeks from today on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio.